The words Walt Disney Pictures appear from darkness in shades of golden orange. A louvered castle appears above, and a shooting star arcs over it until the entire logo fades from view. In darkness, bioluminescent tentacles undulate underwater, and a delicately veined membrane unfurls, revealing a title, Aliens of the Deep. The glowing letters gleam on an ebony surface, then the title fades away. A dark round eye opens. Time-lapse footage captures a sunrise. Beyond the silhouette of a domed observatory, golden clouds scud across the sky as the sun climbs higher.
At the center of our existence is a powerful dynamo.
In a sunny backyard, kids play in the sprinkler.
The sun. It gives us heat and light and drives the great engine of life.
In fast motion, pedestrians move down a city sidewalk. Then lights blur as nighttime traffic speeds through an intersection. Under a blue sky on a bustling thoroughfare, people move in a crowd. Then a dancer in a dark club twirls neon green glow sticks. Solar flares burst from the sun's red-hot surface, spewing ribbons of yellow light. On Earth, grass grows in a field, and a cow grazes. On a patio, a boy eats a hamburger.
It's the food chain, and we're all a part of it.
A montage shows a chimp, an owl, and a praying mantis.
No matter who you are, even if you're a hardcore meat eater, your dinner started with plants somewhere turning sunlight into food. So we are, all of us, solar powered.
A man answers his cell phone, and an elephant extends its trunk. In Egypt, sunlight warms stone statues.
Maybe the ancient Egyptians were right to worship the sun. For 4 billion years, the sun has given life to everything. On land, and in the sea.
A young woman sits at the controls of a submersible as it plunges underwater. The submersible has a transparent pressure hull, resembling a bubble. In this clear sphere, the pilot wears a headset and cruises the sea floor. Two gripper arms extend from the front of the sub.
Rover 1, this is Rover 2. We are at the edge of the wall and are beginning our descent. Over.
My name's Dejana Figueroa, and I'm a PhD student at UC Santa Barbara.
This is cool.
Copy that. Starting descent. Over.
I think I have one of the coolest jobs in the world.
Check out those corkscrew coral down there.
I'm a marine biologist. I get to go to the bottom of the ocean and study the amazing organisms that live there. There's nothing I'd rather be doing.
A descending submersible shines a bright light on a sheer wall. In the spherical cockpit, a goateed man scans the blue water.
Now this wall's pretty amazing. We're barely on the edge of photosynthesis right here. Ambient light's really going now.
Two submersibles sink deeper, following the wall.
You're totally reliant on the technology that's in your little bubble to dive to that depth where it's just a mystery down there. You never know what you're going to see.
Look at all that krill.
Oh my gosh!
Small crustaceans flit through the water.
Looks like we're in krill heaven over here, Rover 1.
Yeah, roger that. Pretty incredible.
A blizzard of krill swirls around the bubble-shaped cockpits. Later, the submersibles drift in inky blue water, their lights shining on the sheer wall. The goateed man scans several monitors mounted in his sphere, showing video footage of the rugged formation.
I'm not seeing much of anything alive here, Dejana. What about you?
Not much life at all. I think we're pretty much out of the photic zone.
It's like being on the moon, huh?
Copy that.
On a rock, a flower-shaped organism stands alone.
So, Dejana, we got a crinoid here. We finally found a citizen.
Copy that.
Yeah, it looks like we're getting deeper. Most of the animals down here look like they're suspension feeders or particle feeders.
With no light from the surface, not much can survive down here.
The rovers move through dark water.
But there are places in the ocean where sunlight has never reached.
not since the world began, and yet amazing life forms thrive there.
So when I was invited to join the new expedition to explore these places, I had to say yes.
On the surface, two ships motor together.
Keldysh, Harris Bridge.
Yeah, Dave, we're about to be in dive brief right here.
In a briefing room, the goateed man meets with his team. Miniature submersibles sit on a map.
I'm Jim Cameron, and here's the deal. I love this stuff. Exploration. Real honest-to-God deep ocean exploration. This is way more exciting than any made-up Hollywood special effects.
These deep ocean expeditions always seem like space missions to me. So why not combine outer space and inner space?
Cargo bay doors open for a capsule-shaped submersible. Dejana climbs aboard an inflatable tender, and the motorboat pulls away from a big white ship and heads toward an orange-hulled vessel.
Sure, we'll take marine biologists, but why not take astrobiologists and space researchers?
The team rides with Dejana.
So that's how a bunch of space scientists wound up out here, 1,000 miles from the nearest land, where right under our feet, down in the darkness, are the most insane alien life forms that have ever been discovered. Two ships, four manned submersibles, 40 dives at 10 sites in both the Atlantic and Pacific.
Workers unload a rover.
I like big operations, but this one was off the hook.
So Jim debriefs his team.
Come down together like this, and we'll try to stay a couple of meters apart because we don't want to drift off. If the communications are compromised with multiple subs in the water, all working on the same frequency, some in Russian, some in English, we want to make sure we stay on visual.
The plan was to coordinate a four-sub dive using both ships, so two mirrors and two rovers could rendezvous at the bottom. This would be a world first.
More people arrived by boat.
Dr. Sagalevich?
Anatoly Sagalevich heads the manned submersibles laboratory for the Russian Academy of Sciences. We've been working together for almost a decade.
There we are.
Yeah.
The adventurers.
Yeah. It's all his fault that we're doing this, because we did Titanic twice in 95 and 01, and then we did Bismarck. Sometime around the middle of Bismarck, Anatoly says, these wrecks are good, they're interesting, but you have to do something real.
Yeah.
You have to do something real, you have to do some science.
Yeah.
Something real.
Zhenya Chernayev is one of the Russian Mir pilots. He's been flying submersibles for over 20 years now.
The most important thing about this boat, of course, is the view. 320 degrees, unobstructed.
This view makes the rovers unique. But because of the acrylic sphere, they can't go as deep as the mirrors. So they'd only be joining us for the Atlantic leg of the journey.
A man controls a boxy robot.
We also had Jake, the little remotely operated bot we'd used to explore the Titanic and Bismarck wrecks. Jake had been modified to test a variety of sampling tools. My brother Mike is Jake's inventor and our pilot on this expedition. His challenge was to steer Jake safely around the volcanically active vent sites and not fry our little bot. This would hopefully allow us to get up close and personal with the creatures we'd come to see.
We've checked the decks twice. All the rigging looks squared away.
My other brother was with us, too. J.D. was the safety and communications officer on board the Ares, or as he called it, crap job number 27.
Our launch procedure is as per the book. Everything's straightforward. She's first, she's second. Recovery is determined by Jim from the bottom. That recovery can go either way.
A small motorboat cruises along the orange-hulled vessel.
We chose the Ares for the giant A-frame at her stern.
On the back of the boat, steel beams form a tall rectangular frame. At night, a rover dangles from the A-frame as the beams angle off the stern, moving the submersible under the water.
Its massive hydraulic cylinders can lift the sub off the deck and out over the water with ease. It's one of the safest ways to launch a large payload off of any ship. And we constantly tested our procedures until we had everything dialed in for the upcoming four-sub dive.
You're in the water.
On a sunny day, the team meets in the briefing room.
All right, let's do this, all stations, let's do this.
I'm going to need everybody to keep their ears open, be observant, keep their eyes open for the lights of the other submersibles, and, it's going to be challenging. It's going to be challenging, but I think we can pull it off.
On deck, JD and his crew ready a rover.
Finally, everything was in motion.
Other crew members test propellers.
Yes,
and in the middle of the North Atlantic, a 1,000 miles from the nearest land,
Jim meets in the briefing room.
Four subs, no waiting.
Our little expedition was about to make history.
On deck, Jim gestures.
We're in motion.
A worker detaches a cable from a submersible. Someone closes a hatch, and the crew moves a rover on deck.
Nice and slow, Blue Wedge. Nice and slow.
Now we're gunning and running, huh?
Yeah.
At least, that was the plan.
All stop.
The Ares bobs over gentle waves. At the stern, the A-frame lists toward the front of the boat.
I copy you, Lima Charlie. The only problem we have right now is the A-frame, over. I'll let you know as soon as your crew has it sorted.
About an hour and 15 minutes ago, we had a safety stop. What we know is the A-frame went south. It's a complete breakdown of the cylinder. It ultimately amounts to a cold stop. These bolts all shot, and all this paint that's been here forever busts loose because of that situation. And it happened on that one as well.
Jim shakes his head.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're in the middle of the ocean with a broken A-frame. So it sounds like to me. How are you going to get that fixed up? Call A-Frames R Us, you know, have their little service ship come by, 1,000 miles from shore.
We don't have to move on it immediately, but it's at least something we need to start processing.
Jim rubs his face, then folds his arms across his chest.
Well, I mean, if they can't fix this, and we don't have an alternate way of launching the sub, it's over. The expedition's over.
If you are going to explore, you have to accept the fact that on the one hand there's risk. You have to stay up all night long thinking about every single factor that's involved in what you're doing and making sure that you've thought of everything. Because if you can eliminate all the things you can think of, you've eliminated 9/10 of what can go wrong. That way when that last 1/10 pops up and you're in the middle of it, you don't have to worry about all the other stuff because you've dealt with that.
Look, to be completely serious, your idea about cutting that bulwark away, watch it to the side. Best idea I've heard for an ultimate plan yet.
Just cut the side right out of the ship.
I say we go clear that with the captain right now.
Okay. Well, plan B.
Sitting on a tall ladder, a man aims his torch at the ship's bulwark and cuts the high wall in a shower of sparks. Other workers torch different parts of the ship. Lighting up the night, sparks spew from the side of the ship and fizzle in the water. Jim makes a cutting motion with his hand as he talks with a member of the crew. Later, workers use cables to steady a section of the bulwark as it's removed. Jim watches with J.D.
I think we talked it through tonight, but I don't think we should try for an all-up drill tonight. I mean, people have been up since 4:30 in the morning.
On a clear day, the Ares motors across open water. The cutout in the wall along the side of the ship reveals the deck. Small inflatable motor boats float alongside the ship.
It became apparent that the only way to get the subs off the Ares was to use the main crane and by sliding the submersibles off the side of the vessel. With a crane that is 30, 40, 50 feet above the actual pick point of the submersible, once an object starts to swing, you can't stop it. It's called the wrecking ball effect. Once it gets away from you, you can't get it back.
Jim sits at a table and points at a sketch with a pencil.
I'm guessing we've got 6 to 8 feet of travel here.
It ultimately resulted in Jim writing a 40-page manual on what he thought the best way to launch the vessel was.
This eye feeds into that.
And so we spent a long time devising 4 separate pick points as well as 8 different points of connection to the submersible to stop it from swaying.
The crew uses ropes to steady a load dangling from a crane.
And we would practice all night long. At dawn the following day, we were ready to attempt it for the first time.
We spent the past 24 hours rebuilding the entire launch and recovery system, which required us to cut this wall out, re-rig every capstan, re-rig every block and tackle.
JD untangles a rope.
We've got about 20 different points of rigging. Every single point has to be checked by me by hand. Any single point fails, anything from the Blue Winch to the cable itself snaps, breaks. Not only do we lose the sub, but we risk the chance of losing somebody on the deck. I'm looking at every pulley under tension, and it's looking at me.
The crew lowers a motorboat over the side of the ship. On the bridge, JD uses a radio.
Keldysh, be advised we're go for launch ops.
Deck crew, be advised we have 15 minutes before we start launch operation. Fall.
Yeah, roger that, DP control. Mirror 1's going into the water right now.
In a control room.
Let's see the crane, guys.
A monitor shows a crane lowering a capsule-shaped submersible to the water. A crew approaches in an inflatable motorboat, and a man climbs onto the submersible to disconnect the crane. Boarding a submersible, a blonde-haired scientist pulls herself through the bottom hatch, then smiles as she sits at the controls. A crewman removes a cover from the rover's acrylic sphere, and the woman smiles.
Oh, yeah.
Let's
do
that. Get on our line.
Bye-bye.
Dejana boards another submersible.
Step. Straps off.
A crewman detaches straps connected to a rover, and a crane lifts it over the ship's side.
Keep going.
Another crane hoists a capsule-shaped submersible. Tether lines connected to the rover keep it steady as the crane swings the submersible over the water. A motorboat crew approaches. As the rover plunges underwater, bubbles churn around the cockpit, and the blonde scientist beams. Two capsule-shaped submersibles slowly descend from the surface.
DP Control, this is Keldysh. The mirrors are beginning their descent. Over.
Say goodbye to the surface world.
Jim pilots a rover submersible.
I love this part.
Everything is a go. We are ready to vent.
SOSO, Rover 1.
We're about to start our tandem descent.
Camera looks clear.
Okay, here we go. And 3, 2, 1.
Venting. Go, go, go.
Okay, we're venting now.
Venting now.
Water churns above a rover.
All right. Rock and roll. Here we go.
The capsule-shaped mirror subs sink in tandem. Text appears. Lost City, Mid-Atlantic Ridge, 870 meters, in cool blue water, bubbles stream from a descending rover.
The descent to Lost City takes about 30 minutes, which is plenty of time to think about what you're about to do.
The blonde rover pilot descends with a young man.
My name is Loretta Hidalgo, and I'm an explorer.
Copy that, Rover 1. This is Rover 2. We hear you loud and clear.
My goal is to one day explore the reaches of space.
In the inky depths, rover lights illuminate a spired rock formation.
That is the bomb. Yeah.
We're at 840 meters.
Surface, this is Rover 2. We are at 840 meters. We are on the bottom.
A mirror submersible glows nearby.
God, these structures are gorgeous. Okay, there's the rendezvous point, and they are right there.
Loretta's rover descends to the sea floor.
Mirror 2, this is Rover 2. Do you copy?
We were doing something that no humans had ever done. This was the first time that four deep submersibles had ever dived together.
The water pressure that you get down at 3,000 feet is mind-boggling.
I mean, if you've ever carried a bucket of water, you know, that's about a foot of water. Now imagine being under 3,000 feet of water. And all that weight of all those buckets lined up on your head are all pressing down on you and on the submarine. Definitely not something that humans were evolved to do.
Okay, Loretta, can you relay to Mike that we are in position for bot ops? Over.
Copy. Mirror 2, are you go for bot deploy?
Roger that, we'll get set for bot ops, over.
Okay, Mir 2 discharges the boxy robot.
There's Jake. Can you see his tether spinning out? That's like a spider spinning its web.
Mike watches camera footage on a monitor and uses a control stick to steer Jake the bot on a long tether.
I'm just going to pull a little tether out here to the left into the current, and then I'll yaw back to the right.
We were really pushing the boundary of being out in an extreme environment.
The bot approaches Rover 2.
I had this incredible experience of feeling like I'd been transported into the future.
Hi, bot!
And I was on a space mission, and we were watching another spacecraft coming up to work with us.
The bot films Loretta.
Hi, Mike. Get me out of here.
Affirmative.
The bot moves into darkness, its light shining on a branching sea fan. In Mir 2 with Dejana, Mike watches Jake's footage of the fan and nudges the control stick.
Push in a tiny bit here, and I come just right in as close as I can go.
The bot's Jake cam shows the fan, which resembles a small white tree.
Oh, wow. Are you seeing the structure?
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay, Mike, if you come right about 30 degrees and come forward, you'll come to
a big fan right on the corner of that rock. Over.
The Jake cam focuses on another delicate fan.
Oh, this is gorgeous. I feel like I'm out there.
Are you liking this?
I'm loving this.
Mike adjusts the control stick.
Okay, I'm going to have to come up a little bit. Oh, we're doing pretty good here. I'd encountered a little more current than I expected right here.
Jake films a fish with a downturned mouth.
Don't mess with me.
He's like, don't even mess with me. Oh my God.
The bot backs up on its tether, and the Jake cam shows the long, slow-moving fish swimming close to equipment mounted on the submersible.
Wow.
In a ship's cabin, a short-haired man juggles oranges.
Kevin Han is one of our astrobiologists, and he's a brilliant guy. Really.
That's one of the interesting things I think about the Europa Ocean, is that you can ask two questions about life on Europa. Could life have originated on Europa?
Astrobiology is the study of life on other worlds. But since Kevin doesn't have any real extraterrestrial specimens to analyze yet, he's out here doing the next best thing, looking at life in extreme conditions of the deep ocean.
Kevin climbs into a rover cockpit.
He's a theory guy, and he's never been to sea before, let alone inside a submersible headed to the bottom of the ocean.
Here we go. Into the unknown.
The rover plunges underwater. At the bottom of the ocean, craggy rock formations tower from the seafloor. They taper to a point like giant stalagmites. A mere submersible illuminates a cluster. Text appears. Lost City, Mid-Atlantic Ridge, 870 meters. A rover shines its light into a cavern, while a nearby mirror submersible illuminates a sheer wall plunging into the deep.
Yeah, it looks like it goes down for a long ways. Mirror 2 is right above us. Very few people get to see Mirror 2 from this angle. That is fantastic.
Kevin studies the hull of the submersible as it glides away with a whirling propeller. Light glows on a steep wall.
The scale of these things is so much larger than I had imagined. It's just amazing. We've got this huge, huge carbonate structure. Unbelievable.
Jim sits in a rover.
It's just the hot water just flowing up and slowly forming. It's like stalactites, upside-down stalactites are slowly deposited, millennium after millennium.
Light glints on pointy ridges.
So what's interesting about these is that you don't necessarily need plate tectonics. You need some means for the water to react with the deep mantle rock. And then you get the serpentinization reaction, which produces the heat that drives the formation of such systems. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Roger that.
A mere submersible trains shafts of light on a bulbous rock formation. A propeller in the stern picks up speed, and the hull swings over a rugged drop-off. Kevin's rover gently ascends, floating around a conical formation and illuminating the craggy surface. A close view of the peak reveals pits and jagged edges. A current blurs part of the image.
There's warm water up here.
Yeah. The vent float is just coming right up out of here.
A robotic arm reaches out from the rover toward a formation.
Wow, this is just amazing. Our technology is just at the level now where we can safely explore the depths of our own ocean.
Kind of friable.
Yeah.
A gripper on the robotic arm breaks off a small piece of rock.
Yeah, look at that. We got a rock.
Hey, we got a sample.
As the rover glides through inky water, Kevin adjusts his headset.
Rover one, this is Rover two.
Oh my goodness, look at that.
Christ.
Holy cow.
a transparent sea creature resembling a sheer scarf drifts in the current.
That is absolutely unreal.
Steven, get your lights right on him.
Roger that.
Oh my goodness. Look at that. It's just amazing.
Jim looks on.
Oh man, look at this thing. Look at this thing. It's incredible.
A thin ring-shaped membrane billows around a glowing core, rippling in the gentle current, as smaller krill dart around it, glinting in electric blue light.
How can something like that be alive? How does a creature like this work? That is absolutely phenomenal.
The creature elongates. In his cockpit, Jim spins wheels on a camera rig, and monitors show close-ups of the creature, which drifts just outside his sphere.
You see the reticulation inside this thing? Look at that. That is amazing.
Thin veins line the sheer membrane.
I have no idea what that is.
The creature softly glows.
You know, that's what I love about this stuff. Every single dive, you're going to see something you've never seen before. And you might even see something that nobody's ever seen before.
The flowing, translucent creature changes shape as it drifts. The view dissolves to a solid brown creature shaped like a hook, with thin filaments that ripple in the current. On the seafloor, a broad, flat-bellied fish with spiky fangs swings its tail fin as it cruises the bottom. Eyes protrude from its back, which is mottled like granite.
Are you seeing this thing? Look at this. This is like the ugliest fish in the world.
Jim's monitors show close-ups of the fish. On its belly, stubby appendages have toe-like digits.
Oh, he's got feet. Look, he's got feet. He's got like little toe socks.
A mere submersible sinks into the deep, blazing a trail of cool blue light through the darkness.
The thing about deep diving is, you always need to expect the unexpected.
A long camera lens mounted on the submersible adjusts as tentacles burst into view.
Oh my God, look at that squid! Oh, it's massive!
Wing-shaped fins flap at the end of its long tubular body. Kevin peers out a window as the pointy-headed squid descends.
Absolutely fantastic.
A pale fish with a round, dark eye swims near the bottom. Flapping broad fins along its side, it makes a sweeping turn. Its long body tapers into a spear-shaped tail. Gently beating its fins, the slow-moving fish cruises the barren seafloor. On a rock formation, a pale octopus with a bulbous head and a dark round eye uses suckers along the bottom of its flexible legs to pull itself over the rugged surface. A school of smaller snub-nosed fish congregates in a rocky cavern. Their grayish bodies taper into flexible tail fins that wave gracefully back and forth. In inky blue water, an oblong organism emits cascading pulses of light. A yo-yo-shaped organism dangling two thread-like tendrils floats near a mirror submersible. In the sub, Diana looks out a small round window.
Look at that fish. You see that guy?
A tall, thin fish with a diamond-shaped body shifts its round eye. Small fins flutter as it gently swings its tail and drifts sideways, sinking into the dark water. On a jagged rock formation, a round orange-hued organism waves long, spiny tentacles. A ghostly white octopus with eight broad arms flaps ear-like fins as it moves over a rocky surface.
All right, we got us a Dumbo. Hoping for this for a while. What a beautiful animal. What a beautiful animal. Look at that. Like a dancer.
The gently beating fins glow softly as the octopus gracefully moves through the clear water.
An amazing creature.
As the Dumbo octopus gently glides over the rock, it slowly waves its bioluminescent fins, which slowly glow. Delicate webbing ripples around its eight legs. Swimming slowly above the seafloor, the octopus flaps its fins and extends its legs.
God, I could watch this guy all day. Almost looks like he's glowing from within.
A soft white light illuminates its beating fins and its pale head. Its darker legs flare out, like the petals of a lily in bloom. The octopus floats, suspended in the blue depths, as the image fades to black. In deep water near a rock formation, a rover floats near a mirror submersible.
Mir 1, Mir 1, this is Rover 2, do you copy? Mir 1, Mir 1, this is Rover 2, do you copy?
It's intermittent, Tim. Sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Roger, Mike, we're seriously low on power and we'll have to leave the bottom. I cannot get a hold of Vince.
We must go up.
Kevin peers out of the rover's cockpit.
Jenya, we must go up.
In Mir 1.
Oh, he's trying to say something about... Calm.
He's trying to say, look out the porthole. Look at
I can't see him.
Can you call surface?
He's saying up and over, pointing.
We need you to contact the surface that we are ascending.
The view from Mir 1 shows someone in the rover's clear sphere holding up a notebook.
Can't read it. Zoom in. Here, let's see if you can read the sign.
A close-up shows a handwritten note.
Contact surface, must surface.
Okay, Roger.
Okay, understood. We'll contact them right now.
Kevin gives the thumbs up.
Ares surface com, rover 2 leaving the bottom at X minus 244, Y minus 25, depth 741 meters.
Rover 2 slowly ascends. Just below the surface, a diver attaches a line to the rover. While the cockpit's submerged, the crane lowers a strap, and a crewman on top of the rover attaches it to a harness. The strap grows taut. As the crane tugs the rover to the surface, the crewman dives into the sea. Water streams off the rover as the crane hoists the sub toward the ship. Lines attached to the rover steady the sub as it's hauled through the opening cut in the side of the Ares.
All three together. All three together. Nice and slow, gentlemen. Nice and slow.
On deck, JD supervises the placement of the rover onto a platform.
Okay.
Jim climbs out of the rover.
How was it, Jim? Good. Definitely got it.
Kevin disembarks.
Wow, that thing is phenomenal.
Yeah.
How you doing?
He hugs Deanna.
Yeah.
What did you see, man?
Oh, it was just incredible. Just incredible. There was a huge, the jellyfish is...
some type of gelatinous...
massive, like a meter. We think that it was feeding off of the amphipods and the plankton and the copepods that were next
hanging
to
out
the,
at the light.
Hanging out at the light, yeah. How's it work?
I don't know, but it's there, so it's working somehow.
Exactly.
Life's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks.
Team Rover.
Oh, Team Rover.
On deck, on a sunny day, a woman adds canisters to a device.
My name is Maya Tolstoy, and I'm a marine seismologist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. I study underwater volcanoes, and particularly I study the earthquakes that these volcanoes make. And I'm trying to understand how the Earth is made, how the surface of the planet is formed. I'm going to be deploying ocean bottom seismometers. Those are instruments that listen to earthquakes and other noises on the ocean floor.
Seismometers line the deck, and a crane lifts one up.
In the ocean, your light only goes so far. And so sound allows you to basically see the bottom of the ocean and to see into the ocean crust, the way that light lets you see on the surface.
The crane lowers the seismometer to the sea. Free-falling, it sinks to the bottom.
We put the instruments over the side of the ship. They drop. They gather the data. Normally, I don't have to dive in order to do my job. So it was very exciting to finally see the environment that I've been working on for over a decade.
Mir 2, copy.
9 North, East Pacific Rise, 3,150 meters. In Mir 1, cruising the seafloor, Maya peers out a porthole.
Yep, it's out my window. It looks like a spaceship.
Mir 2 cruises nearby. In Mir 1, with Kevin and Jenya, Maya stares out her window at the rocky bottom.
That's incredible. That's like another planet.
A rock formation drops off in a sheer cliff, and a sea creature swims into the depths.
It's such an incredible world down there, and it's so important to the formation of our planet. It's where two-thirds of the surface of our world was created, and we still know so little about it.
Jagged rocks glint.
You see how they're all shiny and glassy?
Oh, yeah, look at that.
And that shows that it cooled super quickly. That's just like it really turns to glass, basically, to obsidian, it's called.
Look at that.
And you see how there's hardly any sediment on it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it's really fresh. This is brand new crust we're looking at.
Wow.
Like, can you just imagine being down here when this stuff erupts? Molten rock oozing out and hitting the freezing cold water. I can't imagine. It must have been insane.
Must look pretty cool.
For the few seconds before you die.
The mirror's bright lights cut through the darkness, illuminating the knobby bottom. Maya sets a photo of the baby in her porthole.
I miss my son. He's 5 months old. It was such a hard decision to make to come out here. But I think it's important to study one of the most remarkable phenomena we've ever discovered in the oceans.
In another submersible, Jim uses a radio.
Going upslope on this heading, the chimney should be at the top of this sulfide mound. Over.
Roger that.
Kevin and Maya stare out the small round windows. In deeper water, spires of rock jut out of a rock formation. Amid the camera and equipment mounted on the submersible, a light glares brighter.
Wow. There it is.
Black plumes of smoke spew out of the rock spires. Slack-jawed, Maya looks on. Her keen eyes scan the chimneys. Endless streams of thick black smoke billow into clear water. Now, a computer-generated image of planet Earth hurtles through space. White clouds swirl over blue oceans and green continents.
All around our world, running down the middle of the oceans like seams on a baseball, are these cracks, these spreading centers, where the crust of the planet is literally ripping apart.
A fissure splits an ocean floor.
Up above, the sea looks normal.
The view dives past two ships and plunges underwater.
But 2 miles down, it's a violent landscape where fresh lava flows out of the crack and freezes into rock.
A deep gorge scars the bottom of an ocean.
When the seawater seeps down to the molten rock just beneath the new crust, it gets superheated, far hotter than boiling. But it can't boil because of the intense pressure at the bottom of the ocean. So it comes roaring up out of the seafloor. When the superheated water hits the freezing ocean, minerals condense out, forming the chimneys and creating the black smoke.
Chimney vents emit white-hot fluids glowing like torches. Black smoke rises from the tips, and the surrounding water glows light blue. The view rises above the towering chimney and the black plumes of smoke. Specks in the water glow like stars in a night sky. The animated view dissolves to real footage of active chimneys. Black smoke billows into blue water, forming dense clouds.
When you see black smoke, what you're really seeing is a blowtorch of superheated water.
A robotic arm extends from a mirror submersible. Kevin uses a radio.
We're getting in position to get a water sample from the top of one of these structures. Over.
Yeah, roger that. That's good.
One of the submersible's robotic arms, with grippers on the end, nears a gushing chimney.
Okay, let's get in as close as we can to this chimney, Jenya.
These chimneys reach 750 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's hot enough to melt the windows of your submersible. That's a bad thing. Mental note, don't melt the windows of the submersible.
Smoke billows toward the mirror sub.
Guys, we're getting really close to this black smoker here.
Close enough?
Yeah, I think this is maybe a little too close. Well, we're starting to get into the plume.
Oh, my God. It's like right underneath the sub.
Okay, I stepped right back.
A propeller on the stern whirls to life, drawing the submersible backward out of the black plume.
That's normal. We usually drive right in them like that.
We were right on top of it. That was a little freaky.
In a lab, the needle on a pressure gauge jumps. While Dejana peers through a microscope, Kevin splits a rock sample.
Oh, that's pretty cool, Kevin.
The geology's fascinating.
But it's not why I came out here.
Snake Pit, Mid-Atlantic Ridge, 3,500 meters.
Caldish, Mir 2. We are on the bottom. Depth 3,526 meters. And we are at the top of the Moose structure. Over.
Dejana looks out a window at rock formations.
These sites were first visited 25 years ago by geologists. And they weren't looking for life.
Chimneys spew smoke.
But it wasn't until they got into a submersible and went down to the bottom to see with their own eyes. It was like, oh my God. There's life down here, and it's beautiful. It's an entire ecosystem.
A fish swims around a rock tower, and Dejana looks on.
Wow, that's awesome.
Shrimp dart around a smoking chimney as the mirror gets closer.
Look at all that hot water.
They are right in the flow.
Water rises in a blur from a jagged surface where shrimp congregate. Another vent flares like a torch.
Oh man, check this out. It's like liquid fire. These guys are dancing right next to it. They are really tickling the dragon's tail.
Shrimp blanket a formation spewing smoke.
The science community was stunned. How could these animals be living in these toxic chemicals? At these pressures, around extremes of temperature, from freezing to beyond boiling in just a few inches.
Shrimp swim around a rock tower.
How could there be a whole ecosystem living without sunlight?
A rugged surface teems with pale pink shrimp.
And not just living, but thriving.
Shrimp swim around black smoke, and Jim looks on.
Unbelievable. This is the most insane amount of biomass I ever saw in my life.
Wow. Holy pancakes, Batman.
A mass of pale pink shrimp with thread-like antennae cover a surface, while the rising current carries some higher.
And they're right there in the flow,
just enjoying the hydrothermal fluid.
Oh, look at them swarming. They love it in the smoke.
Oh, yeah.
The vents were providing the energy for life. It was coming from chemicals dissolved in the water, coming from inside the Earth itself. Not photosynthesis, but chemosynthesis.
Shrimp frolic in a blur of gushing water.
It was a whole new basis for life, one that didn't need the sun, only water and heat.
That party's been going on down there in the dark for the last billion years, and it's going to be going on for the next billion years. They're just doing their thing. It's got nothing to do with us. The sun could go out tomorrow, and they wouldn't know, and they wouldn't care.
On a ship's prow, Kevin stands on a viewing platform.
Exploring and discovering ecosystems like this, which may not depend on energy from the sun, opens up all sorts of interesting possibilities when we think about the search for life elsewhere.
He swims in the ocean.
Wherever we found liquid water on planet Earth, we found life. That's pretty profound.
He dives underwater wearing a mask and flippers.
If we find liquid water elsewhere in the solar system, are we going to find life? We won't know unless we start searching.
The blue water around him fades to black, and his image disappears as a computer-generated spacecraft comes into view and drifts through space.
In fact, NASA is planning a mission called the Jupiter Icy Moons Orbiter, aka JIMO. At 120 feet long, it's going to be several times larger than any planetary probe ever launched. And its nuclear reactor will power ion engines and a big science radar.
The spacecraft drifts toward one of Jupiter's moons. The reddish-brown planet looms behind the stone-gray moon.
The main goal of JIMO will be to use that radar to look down through the ice of Jupiter's three largest moons. First, it will study Callisto, and then it'll move to Ganymede. And these are bizarre moons, the largest of Jupiter's 61 known moons. Callisto and Ganymede both have crusts of ancient ice and rock that may hide oceans miles below the surface.
Sunlight warms a golden moon, half in shadow.
Further in is Io, which is a moon of fire, not ice.
Io has a mottled yellow surface.
Io's eccentric orbit causes it to deform as it circles Jupiter. This intense tidal pumping pulls at the moon like taffy, generating friction at the core, which then becomes heat
and this heat drives the solar system's largest active volcanoes.
Shadows move across the moon as it orbits Jupiter.
There are constant eruptions, rivers of lava, and volcanic plumes shooting hundreds of miles into space.
An erupting volcano spews smoke and particles. The aerial view sails over the glowing orange crater where veins of molten rock streak the olive-green landscape. Soaring away, the view flies off into orbit.
But the gem of the Jovian system, at least as far as the search for life is concerned, is Europa. It's here where fire and ice come together in perfect harmony.
Brown streaks line Europa's surface.
The scientific community is relatively certain that beneath the icy, chaotic shell of Europa, there exists a liquid water ocean with twice the volume of all the Earth's oceans combined. So tidal heating is working here too, keeping that water from freezing, and possibly providing energy for life, the same kind of life that we're finding at the deep vents here on Earth.
Underwater, a mere submersible descends to the bottom. Guaymas Basin, East Pacific Rise, 2,100 meters. The sub's lights sweep over multicolored patches modeling a rocky surface.
You see all that out there? All that yellow and white and orange? That's just a huge colony of microbes.
This is just acres and acres of this bacterial mats.
Organisms cover a formation.
This could be like a little glimpse back in time.
Yeah, a couple billion years ago.
Hydrothermal vents have been on planet Earth since the oceans were formed. It may have been sites like these around which life itself began.
If we can just sort of scoop up top area of that, maybe a little bit of the sediment below.
The gripper on the mirror's robotic arm grabs a soft orange-colored mass.
You can see all the stringy little filaments that make up the mat.
Micrographs show rod-shaped filaments.
Extremophiles are simply life forms that thrive in the extremes of temperature and pressure and radiation environments that to us are deadly. These microbes go far beyond anything which our imagination could conceive of back when we first started studying where we might find life.
Now, if we find anything on Europa, it's probably going to look just like this.
Absolutely.
In a briefing room, the team meets with a scientist.
So I think if we're going to try to get evidence for life on another planet, we've certainly got to look for evidence for life on our own first. It's the only sample we've got, right?
Pam Conrad. She was one of our senior astrobiologists. She comes from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and she's one of those valuable people who knows how to make science fun.
She makes a funny face. Later, in a submersible.
So you know when you're little and you used to play like you were in a submarine? That was this. How cool is this? This is way better than the cardboard box.
Pam flashes a wide smile. Text appears, Guaymas Basin, East Pacific Rise, 2,100 meters. The sub descends, shining two cones of light into the deep as it nears the bottom. A rock formation has a disc-shaped cap.
Dolia, just see if you can ease in on this structure.
Absolutely.
It's just like the mushroom planet. It looks exactly like a mushroom.
The smooth, glassy bottom of the disc reflects the mirror submersible and its bright, glaring lights.
Ah, that's gorgeous. It's like a mirror.
Bubbling water rises above the disc, waving and blurring. Calm water flows below, where the disc mirrors craggy rock.
That's the hot water forming a surface.
That is very cool.
See the bacteria growing right along the edge, right in the hot flow?
I see it.
It's all bacterial mats on top.
Certain molecules found in living organisms will glow when they're hit with an ultraviolet laser.
Is that a good place for a fluorometer reading?
I think this is a great place for a fluorometer reading. We designed our life detection tool in such a way that we could point it at a rock and say, aha, there's evidence of life over there.
Lights out.
Jim flips switches.
Okay, I'm going to start the measurement now. Ready?
An instrument beams light into hot water.
Okay, the laser's firing. We got a lot of signal here. Ooh, this is good. We've got like 14,000 counts in ultraviolet.
Very interesting, Doctor. But is it life?
There's definitely organic stuff there. It's so important to study what you can about extreme environments on the Earth before you go out into the solar system and look for life.
At a chimney spewing black smoke, a Mir sub drifts closer. On the Ares, a woman grabs a radio.
Go for Ares.
My name is Kelly Snook. I work at NASA. I'm a planetary scientist.
Copy that.
I study the process of exploration.
The Rover 2 and Mir 2.
She unloads a rock sample.
What I do in my day-to-day work is learn how to use the Earth as a training ground for going to another planet.
So here I was looking for the analogs.
Underwater footage shows the sample collection.
In the basket.
Put it there.
Slam dunk. Slam dunk from the center line.
No, but...
On the ship, Jim shows Kelly, Kevin, and Loretta the white matter on a rock.
Most people were on a ship in the middle of the ocean studying the hydrothermal vents or making a film. I was on Mars. And the people that were down at the bottom of the ocean, they were out on the surface of Mars.
In the ship's briefing room, Jim meets with Kelly and another scientist.
Everything that we do in the ocean is 10 times harder than you think it's going to be, and you go in thinking it's going to be really hard. You know, so I don't see Mars surface ops being any different.
You know, hopefully we'll have time in that day to sort of debug our comm protocols and the way we're interacting with each other.
My team included astronaut Megan MacArthur from NASA Johnson Space Center and astrobiologist Tori Holler from NASA Ames Research Center.
He sets a rock on a lab table.
We worked together to explore ways in which humans and technologies can improve the science and the discoveries we'll make on the Moon and Mars.
On the seafloor, Jake the Bot advances.
This combination of science and technology, especially in an environment like under the ocean, is very similar to space exploration.
A rover drifts underwater.
The submersible is like a pressurized rover on Mars, and so we were using this as an opportunity to learn lessons about space.
On the ship.
Go ahead, Roberto.
If you can find any, you know, microbial meteorite near the chimney, and then also moving.
I guess it depends on how we're able to configure the mirrors and how successful
I would talk
are.
To the remote scientists at NASA, and I would get their requests for particular rocks. And I would process the rocks and prepare to take them back to Earth.
I think it's probably loaded with bacteria. I think the white stuff is most likely, like I say, sulfur oxidizers.
Analogs like this are key to understanding how we'll do scientific exploration on the Moon and Mars.
The robotic arm of a sub grips a carbonate spire and pulls it free.
Will we need manipulators like we have on the Mir? Probably. And how will we handle the problems and technical glitches that no doubt we will have on an extended planetary mission?
In a rover in deep water, equipment goes dark on Jim and a scientist.
Rover 1 and Mir 1, we'd be advised we have lost our starboard horizontal thruster. We've lost AC, and we have lost pan and tilt. So we're probably going to have to abort.
Every event here, both planned and unplanned, generates data we can apply to the future.
A sub's gripper uses a scoop to get a rock sample.
Much of what I study is how humans interact with the technology that allows them to accomplish their tasks. Some of the technology is very simple, but in space and at the bottom of the ocean, nothing is simple.
The robotic arm moves with the rock in the scoop.
Oh.
The arm spills the sample as it pours the scoop in collection jars.
Can't rotate the scoop more?
It's on the edge of this car, so.
You can put it in. Can you rotate the scoop?
Okay.
It's
got,
in?
It's one piece of
cob
inside, you see?
Yeah, okay, good. All right, you got it. One is out, one is in.
The better we can integrate technology like this and robotics into our human exploration systems, the more effectively we'll be able to explore the solar system.
Maya reclines in a Mir sub.
I feel like I'm in a spacecraft.
I'm sorry?
I said, I feel like I'm in a spacecraft.
You are.
It's very cool.
You're in...
inner space.
The world's best spacecraft to explore this planet. You're in it.
The experience of human beings inside the submersible is what we're most interested in.
Jake nears a chimney, and Loretta smiles.
It's
It's Marge. It's Marge Simpson's hairdo.
A black plume resembles a beehive.
It's not only the hardware in the process, but the communications between the people and the robots. Because the scientist is the interface between the technology and what we're trying to study.
Okay, guys, what I'd like you to do is come to your right when you've had a look at that, because we're not getting much of an image here.
And the current is, of course, not favorable.
That's okay. It wouldn't be fun if it was an easy game, Mike.
A fish with a long, slinky tail roams the seafloor.
What's that fish?
It's a big fish. Don't be scared.
Now, if you want to take a sample of any of these small sulfide rocks down here at the bottom, that would be fine.
It's a very technologically difficult thing to do, to pick up a rock at the bottom of the ocean and put it into a sample collection device. That's really at the core of what we're interested in. How are humans going to do these small, easy tasks in a difficult environment?
Well, we got currents. Come on, gripper, grip.
Loretta covers her mouth as she watches from the sub. The Jake cam shows a gripper squeezing a flat rock.
Oh, hang on to it, baby. All right, you got it. Barely got it, but you got it. Okay, try to get it over to the carousel.
Well, a task that would take a person in the field a couple of minutes on Earth can take hours on Mars. Every step is a new challenge.
Jake carries the rock to a collection jar.
Can't send 150 people to Mars right away. We would send probably 6.
In the Mir sub, Loretta looks up from her notes, then turns to look out a porthole with the Russian pilot.
These few people will be responsible for all the science and exploration on the surface. Kind of like proxies for the thousands of people back on Earth interested in the mission.
On the Keldysh, Kelly looks out to sea.
Mars is the obvious first place to look for life in the solar system because there's evidence that the Earth and Mars share a similar history of abundant water. And one of the most important key elements of life as we know it is water.
Computer animation shows Mars in space.
Yeah, the Mars you see today is dry, dusty, cold, apparently dead. But if you set the Wayback Machine, it didn't look like that.
Water appears on the surface.
If you could imagine if life was evolving on Mars and there was an impact great enough.
A streaking meteor crashes into a lake on Mars. The impact sends debris hurtling into space. The view plunges into a rock, revealing knobby filaments.
Based on what we know now about extremophiles, we think that life could survive a trip from Mars to Earth in a rock. It's possible that life could be viable after that long of a trip.
The rock carrying extremophiles hurtles toward planet Earth.
We might all be Martians. We might all be, you know, from another solar system entirely.
In the ship's dining room.
All right, put up your hand if you would sacrifice 10 years of your life to go to Mars.
I'm going. Sure.
Jim eyes Dejana.
How would you talk your husband into letting you go to Mars? Say, all right, honey, now it's only going to be for 5 years. Okay? And I'm going to write every day. We'll have email.
Whoa, that's a loaded question there. You know, it's funny, because when you asked me the question, would I go to Mars, I raised my hand without even thinking about the consequences or life at home, my husband, my cat, my mom and dad, my cat. That'd be hard. I think he'd say go for it. I really do, because I think all of us, we're all human, and we all have that exploration bug in it. And if somebody that we love has the opportunity to go out there and represent humanity and explore, I think he'd push me and go for it.
In the ship's hallway, Loretta reads as she walks.
When you've been on the Keldysh for almost a month, it's very easy to pretend that you're on your way to Mars.
In a lab, she looks at a crab.
You're far away from everything you know, in a small environment with the same crew who are there for the same professional interests that you are. They're there to explore. They're there to do science.
Jenya shows Loretta and Kelly a device with a handle.
The Russians are very resourceful. They're showing us some of their sampling tools, and they have a tool that can sample just about anything you want to sample. Some of the things are really clever, or as simple as the Nikolai pot, which is basically a pot we stole from the cook, Nikolai.
Kelly looks at crabs in the pot, which is mounted outside a sub.
It's something that I just love getting to be a part of.
You know, we get to be in their culture and look at how they do engineering and how they do operations. It's an incredible environment to be working in.
Maya rides in a sub with a Russian pilot.
I love it because of the way it brings people together.
Victor,
Обед?
Lunch?
Yeah.
Yeah?
This expedition captured a lot of that spirit.
Jim meets with a multinational team.
The idea of doing something that was really difficult and how people can come together to make something like that happen. The way they communicate with each other.
No, forward.
Russians use radios. Jim smiles.
Victor's been practicing. Vika, хорошо, хорошо.
People play volleyball on the Keldysh.
One of the things I enjoy about Russian culture is the way they integrate play and work. I mean, I studied Russian in college because I always wanted to work with the Russian space program. And the Keldysh is a great analog for, you know, a space launch complex. And I understood what all the astronauts are always saying when they say that the technicians and the engineers on the pad are the real heroes, making sure that you're going to be safe. This expedition captured a lot of that spirit.
One, engine start.
A rocket launches, smoke billows around the fiery thruster.
While we were out at sea, two incredible explorers were already on their way to Mars.
An animated spacecraft flies in space.
Spirit got there first, blazing into the thin Martian atmosphere at over 12,000 miles per hour.
The heat shield glows red hot as the craft streaks through the atmosphere.
Opportunity arrived a few weeks later. Landing, for both, was a nerve-wracking affair.
A parachute opens, and the disc-shaped spacecraft floats through a hazy orange sky under a glaring sun.
Moving at a speed of 173 miles per hour, we are near our terminal velocity.
The craft deploys an airbag shaped like a bunch of grapes. It dangles as retro rockets slow the descent. The airbag detaches from the craft and bounces on the ground. People monitor from mission control.
Now 6 minutes 37 seconds from atmospheric entry. No signal at the moment. Deep Space Network tracking stations in Canberra and Goldstone are still searching for the primary signal.
The airbag stops and mission control celebrates. Inside the deflated airbag, panels unfold, revealing a four-wheeled rover.
Equipped with high-resolution stereoscopic cameras and a Swiss Army knife's worth of geological and chemical science instruments, the mission of the Mars exploration rovers was clear. Find evidence of water in Mars's past, when conditions may have been more favorable to life.
On an arid plain, the rover wheels over to a rock. A robotic arm unfolds, and a probe rotates into position.
You can learn a lot from a rock, if you know how to ask, and you know where to look.
A device spins, and the probe presses it to the rock.
Of the two rovers, Opportunity really hit the jackpot. The ancient bedrock was absolutely loaded with hematite, an iron-bearing mineral that usually forms from interaction with liquid water. Then scientists detected jarosite, a mineral that suggests the rocks may have been soaked in acid groundwater or in a hot springs environment like Yellowstone National Park.
Black and white micrographs show grooved surfaces.
Other clues included empty cavities inside rocks where salt crystals may have dissolved away, and rippled sediment patterns, hinting at the presence of free-flowing water over thousands of years. And then there were the blueberries. Tiny spheres of hematite eroded out of the rocks and spilled out all over the surface. On Earth, spheres like this form in the presence of water over time. Both Spirit and Opportunity helped confirm where the water was on Mars, but they were not equipped to tell us where the water is now. That job fell to the Mars Odyssey orbiter, which detected what is believed to be massive quantities of water ice just a few feet below the surface, with the highest concentrations at the poles.
Another spacecraft rockets toward Mars.
In 2008, Phoenix will rise from the ashes of the Mars Polar Lander, and using many of that failed mission's spare parts, will land near the Martian North Pole.
The craft deploys landing gear and jettisons its parachute.
And
For the first time ever, a Martian probe will do more than scratch the surface.
Retro rockets slow the craft's descent.
Phoenix will dig deep into the permafrost and sample Martian water for the very first time.
The rover pivots on an arid plain.
Everything we learn about Mars makes the story more exciting. There's evidence of past water. There's evidence of past volcanism. The chemistry checks out. All the ingredients for life are there. That's why we keep searching. Of course, that's not the only way we're searching for life in the universe.
With Jim and Kevin.
I know. It
says SETI Institute on your shirt and on your laptop.
It's a little that's impressive. Over the top.
Yeah.
Impressive. You're putting the message out there.
Well, you know, they gave it to me.
One of the groups I'm affiliated with is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute. And what the SETI Institute does is try to detect intelligent signals from distant civilizations around another star. To do this, Frank Drake, one of the founders of the SETI Institute, wrote down just a set of factors known as the Drake Equation. And it includes factors such as the fraction of stars around which planets form, the fraction of habitable planets on which life emerges, and the fraction of life that then evolves to intelligence.
An animated green creature grows a brain.
And eventually to becoming tool-using civilizations that can communicate with other civilizations in the galaxy.
The creature responds to a celestial object in space.
The last factor is the lifetime of the intelligent communicating civilization. At the same time that we develop the technology to communicate with beings on a distant planet, we also develop the technology to annihilate ourselves. And if that's standard for intelligent civilizations in the galaxy,
a nuclear missile explodes.
We're not going to have much luck searching for life elsewhere.
Let's say that my kind of modified Drake's equation mm-hmm. says that life was possible on any planet, any distance from a sun, or not even anywhere near a sun, or any planetary-like body like a moon of Jupiter or whatever, that had ice around it,
mm-hmm.
okay, and had some kind of tidal pumping from some other gravity source near it, so that it had a liquid core, it was generating heat, and it was making heat like these hydrothermal
exactly.
vents that
yep.
we're seeing. And if we said there were maybe 10 or 20 or 50 times as many worlds like that,
right.
isn't it logical to assume that when we get a call from one of your buddies mm. out there, when SETI Institute finally picks up a signal, it's going to be coming from somebody who had to bore up through ice and set their transmitter out on the ice. Statistically, isn't that indicated by what we're talking about here?
There's a flaw in that statement,
yeah.
and that is ice worlds are most common. We have no idea about that right now.
We got one liquid water planet in our solar system, and we've already identified three potential hydrospheres
yeah.
that are ice-covered and far, far from the sun.
Right.
But so based on our own immediate experience, it's a 3-to-1 ratio.
Sure, sure. Do we know if any of them are habitable?
No, we don't, but we got to go look.
Right.
Computer animation shows a moon in space.
We may find that icy little worlds like Europa are where the bulk of liquid water exists in our galaxy. And in fact, that's where the bulk of life may exist. Who knows? But it is really interesting to think about the evolution of intelligence in an icy world system. Would you evolve to intelligence? Would you wonder about the bottom of that ice shell?
Below ice, the animated green creature shrugs. In the briefing room, Dejana, Kevin, and Jim sit around a bathymetric map.
Our primary focus at this site will be for the mussels and the crabs.
Okay, and you need mussels and crabs. And we're going to do the crabs.
We're
going to
do the crab trap. Yeah, so we're hoping that whatever we fix in the crab trap will attract these guys.
Now, do you care where we put the crab trap?
Preferably where there's crabs.
9 North, East Pacific Rise, 3,150 meters. A Mir sub descends toward a rock formation blanketed with clusters of brown mussels and soft white mats.
The story of the vents is really the story of the microbes.
This is it right here. The bottom of the food chain. Waving fields of bacteria.
The vent fluid is a kind of liquid sunshine, powering the whole food chain down here. Some of the animals are eating the bacteria.
some of them are preying on the ones that eat the bacteria.
Long, narrow eels swim away from a gushing chimney that spews fluid.
It's kind of ethereal, huh? Who would have thought that bacteria could be beautiful?
Thread-like filaments move gracefully with the current. At a rock formation, water blurs as it rises from a vent near a mound of mussels.
The animals are eating the bacteria, but there's something else going on here, too. It's symbiosis, a dance of life between partners of different species. Vent animals like the shrimp and the mussels have formed symbiotic relationships with microbes that can live off of the chemicals in the vent fluid.
Oh, we're near something big, guys. Large mussel beds. This is jackpot.
Dejana peers out a porthole in the mirror sub.
I study the metabolic and molecular physiology of mussels and crabs that live at these deep sea vents. I'm focusing on their ability to withstand variations, large variations in temperature.
A pale crab crawls over the oblong brown mussels, carpeting a craggy formation.
The genus, Bathymodiolus, is the scientific name for the mussels that we study.
We've got a mussel mound over to the right, Jenny. I think this will be a perfect spot to do our mussel collections.
Yes.
Do you see what I'm talking about? You think these are mixed sizes, or can you get some small ones?
We will take small and bigger also.
But I need small.
Only small.
Only small.
Okay.
Malinky. Yeah? Is that small?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
The gripper on a robotic arm picks up a rock covered with mussels.
Keldish, mirror one. We have collected a full batch of mussels in the clam bucket. X minus 487, Y minus 64.
The arm drops the sample in a bucket.
Oh yeah, bingo baby.
Later, the gripper pinches a wire basket filled with small pale crabs. In another sub, Jim uses a radio.
Looks like you got your crabs.
Yes, we got crabs. Big time. It's like full.
You did it.
With jerky motions, the robotic arm swings the basket of crabs toward a square bin mounted on the outside of the submersible, behind the clam bucket.
Bio box is closed. We have crabbage.
We have crabbage.
At night, a crane hoists a mirror submersible out of the water. A wave crashes against the hull, and water churns white on the rolling surface of the sea. Members of the crew attach lines to the dangling sub and guide it back to the ship. Dejana climbs out and triumphantly raises her arms.
Can I open that?
Yeah. A man opens the bio box.
My PhD advisor is Jim Childress. He's been studying hydrothermal vent communities since their discovery in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
And he has years of experience going to sea and doing science in these extreme environments.
He handles a crab.
So the Childress Lab is one of the only labs in the world that's able to keep these animals and maintain them in an environment similar to what they come from.
In a lab, Dejana watches an assistant transfer crabs to a bin.
As fast as we can, we take the animals that were collected and bring them into our lab, where we place them in a maintenance respirometry system.
The device has compartments.
We call this thing the condo. We put the animals in these little condos. We repressurize them up to the pressure that they were collected in, and we make sure that we have them back at the temperature that is optimal for their survival. Then we pick some of the animals to use for our experiments, and we transfer them into another system that's called the high-pressure respirometry system. Now, this system is extremely unique and special because here we can manipulate the environmental conditions. And we look at the metabolic rates of the animals as we vary their environmental condition. And that's what I love to study. By looking at mussels, you can gain a better understanding about temperature adaptation, and that might help us in the future when it comes to the warming of our planet. Global warming is real. It's putting our planet at risk, the life as we know it, not just species. I mean, the whole food chain, the whole ecosystem. And at some point, we're going to have to deal with it.
Dejana walks around a mirror sub stowed on the ship.
I think I got into the ocean because it's It's mysterious to me. It's unknown. Mm-hmm. It's not explored. It hasn't been conquered. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate it, and I have respect for it.
Did you ever think you'd end up here?
Oh, God, no. But I guess this is the path of questions that I tried to answer just led me on a path that ended up here. And so now the question that I'm trying to answer has me taking submarines down to the bottom of the ocean.
In inky blue water, a rod-shaped organism drifts. A flat circular creature with spiny tentacles arranged in a ring floats through the midnight blue depths. On a rock, a jelly with a flexible body shaped like an arrowhead has two long tendrils trailing behind it. A crab with its legs splayed descends to the bottom, where a thick fish swims. In the briefing room, Jim meets with the team.
Okay, let's let the meeting come to order. The dive will be Snake Pit. The pilots will be Dr. Anatoly Sagalevich, Mir 1, Jenya Chernaev, Mir 2. Find a structure that we can work the bot. So we'll land at the base, and we'll just try to work up through the structure. Ideally, up all the way up to a chimney.
There is not supposed to be too much hot venting on the wall. Some shimmering water, but I don't think the hot vents happen until way at the top. Is that correct?
The best way to visualize this stuff is wherever you see something black, that's like a blowtorch. Yeah. That's a blowtorch made out of water.
Underwater, Jake the bot explores near a rock formation. In a Mir sub with Dejana and Victor, Mike steers the bot.
Okay, there's Mir 1.
They're coming up with us, aren't they?
Snake Pit, Mid-Atlantic Ridge, 3,500 meters. Jake advances and turns on its tether, while Mike works the control stick. Dejana holds a radio.
There's an antler-shaped stone bowl that's filled with juvenile rimicaras.
Okay. Roger that.
All right, this is, I think, the structure he was describing, and I think I can get in a little closer to it.
That's it. You should see him now.
Over.
Got it.
Oh, wow. Copy that. We see it.
Shrimp team over a rocky spire.
These little shrimp are different. Are these related?
Yes. The juvenile and adults.
They blanket the surface.
The vent shrimp, Rimicaris exoculata, are grazing on the bacteria growing all around them.
Are you seeing this crab?
I sure am.
Look at them. They're eating the bacteria that's growing all over that crab.
Shrimp peck at it, and the crab swats at them.
Oh, you almost got that guy. Look at that. He's all covered with this bacteria. He doesn't know it. He just thinks the shrimp are picking on him.
The crab kicks a shrimp away.
It's like crab foo here at the bottom of the ocean.
The shrimp colony, there you go.
There it is, let's check that guy out.
Okay.
The J-cam shows shrimp swimming in a gushing plume of smoke.
This is black smoke.
Look at these guys.
I can't believe they're swimming in and out of it. Oops, it's hot.
Okay, if it's not cooking them, it's not gonna cook me, so I'm gonna move in a little closer.
Being bold.
The bot enters the plume. Black smoke obscures the view, and wriggling shrimp flit by.
Let's get out. Back out.
I've got full back command. What the heck?
All right. Let's stay away from that.
They're on us.
They're attacking us.
Look at the shrimp. Love them. They're all over them. The shrimp are loving Jake. Check that out.
Shrimp cling to the front of the bot.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. I can't even see the fly. I just see shrimp.
Their pale bodies glow in the bright lights.
Yeah, it looks like we've got some piggybackers, some shrimp that are along for the ride. Over.
Shrimp swarm the bot as it moves away.
That's amazing.
I can get shrimp at Sizzler.
You can't get this shrimp at Sizzler.
9 North, East Pacific Rise, 3,150 meters. Jake shines its light on a towering formation covered in long tubular organisms with red plumes.
Riftia, the giant tube worms, are hands down the stars of the deep vent community, and also the best example of symbiosis in action.
In the submersible, Mike steers the bot.
We've got a little bit of shimmering water here.
We should be okay. Wow. Oh, this is gorgeous.
These animals don't even have a stomach. They literally can't eat.
Crabs explore a cluster.
They depend completely on a large sac of microbes inside their body, which produces their food.
When you get in really close, you can see some pretty neat stuff.
Oh, wow.
The tube worms with their plumes retracted resemble big straws. Particles drift by as Jake moves closer to a cluster, where a small white crab climbs a shaft toward a red plume.
You see that guy?
Yeah.
Can we grab him?
If you want to, you get ready. I think we're set.
Get ready.
On your mark.
Jake's gripper nears the crab.
Oh, he might come to us.
Go.
The sprightly crab slips away.
Yay. Crab got away.
Tell him nice try.
Nice try, nice try.
Red plumes bend in the gentle current.
They're gorgeous underwater. The long red plume is like a gill. It takes in oxygen and also nutrients from the vent fluid. The worm's job is to keep this plume in the flow, sucking in nutrients which feed the bacteria inside. And it's the bacteria's job to convert the sulfide chemicals into food for the worm.
Particles float past a cluster of plumes.
So the question is, do the bacteria work for the worm, or does the worm work for the bacteria?
A mere sub drifts over a colony.
If these animals didn't exist, we could not have imagined them. It makes me wonder what else is out there, waiting to be discovered.
Dejana smiles at the pilot.
You've got a cool job, Jenya.
Thank you.
On the ship with Jim and Kevin.
So the real question is, could you imagine a colony of these on Europa? Where would the oxygen be coming from? You know, if the whole idea is they don't need sunlight to drive this ecosystem, it's just chemosynthesis,
yeah.
But they need some ambient oxygen.
Yeah.
The oxygen in the water came from
photosynthesis
a million years ago, maybe. It doesn't matter however long it takes for the water to turn over.
Right. So the question becomes, is oxygen necessary for life? It may be for large animals, But if we get down to the microbial level...
Yeah, but we want to see large animals.
You want to see large animals.
We want to see large animals. We don't want to spend all this money to go out into space and find a microbe.
Oh, come on. Microbes are great. You know, they're highly underrated.
They're not good conversationalists. I mean, look, I would want to give up here. Look.
Jim fast forwards footage of tube worms.
What do you think makes life here possible? These guys have this incredible symbiosis with the microbes.
Yeah, they're living on the bacteria. But I'm not going to give a bouquet of bacteria to my mom, but I would give her a bouquet of these Riftia. I mean, look at these things. They're beautiful.
So what Jim says is right. Oxygen is the afterburner that fueled the explosion of multicellular life on our world. And even though chemosynthesis happens beyond the light of our sun, many of the biological processes still require some free oxygen. And this oxygen is typically supplied from photosynthesis at the surface of the Earth. So where might oxygen come from on Europa? Europa's orbit sits within Jupiter's enormous magnetic field. The intense radiation continually slams energetic particles into the European surface and has the potential to transform vast amounts of water ice into things like hydrogen peroxide and molecular oxygen. Assuming those oxidants make their way into the ocean on a regular basis, through cracks and upwellings or comet impacts, they would represent an energy jackpot for any life forms trying to survive there. And so this is where some of the hydrothermal samples come into play again. We're trying to replicate the European surface environment in the lab.
In a lab, Kevin unwraps a rock.
These are rocks from the deep ocean. So let's prep this for the chamber. Maybe take a little piece off of here.
A device has several tubes.
So this is Europa in a can. This part down here is a vacuum chamber. We've got liquid nitrogen coming in, and we can grow ices and basically replicate the surface environment of Europa. Then up here, we've got a high-energy electron gun. And what this does is replicates the radiation environment of the Jovian magnetic field, this tremendously large and powerful magnetic field of Jupiter. What would happen to life exposed to that environment?
A gloved hand uses tweezers to get a rock sample.
We're taking microbes that we found down at the hydrothermal vents, putting them into this environment and bombarding them, blasting them with this high-energy radiation, making sort of a chemical junkyard, a biological chemical compound junkyard. And this is sort of comparable to, say, going to a junkyard here on Earth. And you wander around the junkyard and you see a steering wheel and a tire, and you know that at one point there was a complete car. When we send a spacecraft to Europa, we're going to have to understand what are the chemical and molecular biosignatures that are left behind. Are we seeing that same kind of signature on the surface of Europa? If we do, what does that imply for the habitability of the ocean below?
In computer animation, a spacecraft soars over Europa. Underwater, Dejan appears out of a Mir sub, Menes Gwen, mid-Atlantic ridge, 920 meters.
Menes Gwen's an underwater volcano.
The sub's lights illuminate the water blurring over a barren slope.
It's this really unique place because you have your hydrothermal vents there and shimmering water everywhere.
Mussels form small mounds on the rock. Dejana sits next to Jenya in the sub.
Are we digging this place?
We're digging this place big time. Yeah. Big time.
Craggy spires emit fluid from vents and the water shimmers. White bacterial mats and clusters of mussels carpet the surrounding rock.
You can really see the clear fluids. So these are a little bit cooler because you're not getting the black smoke here.
Gushing fluid blurs as it rises.
The site has an amazing dreamlike quality.
The water glimmers in different shades of blue. Gliding above a slope, a pointy-headed squid ascends toward the submersible. It has a long body and flowing tentacles.
The cooler, clear vent fluid isn't as toxic as the black smokers. So you wind up getting a lot of visitors, including some opportunistic predators.
A crab walks sideways on spindly legs, traversing a rocky surface through shimmering water. On the sub's stern, a propeller gently whirls. Kevin looks out a porthole.
Look at all that shimmering water coming out of the structure. If we can collect a sample down there, that would be fantastic.
Mirror 1, Mirror 2.
It's Mirror 1, go ahead.
Okay, Jim, we're ready now to launch Jake. We're ready to go now.
Jake emerges from the sub.
Here we go. Coming out.
Everything looking okay?
Yeah, it seems okay.
The bot cruises the bottom.
So getting to work with Mike and Jake is just absolutely fantastic, because you can think about this thing as the distant ancestor of a vehicle that may someday explore oceans on other worlds.
Okay, Mike, looking good. You should be able to take your core sample right at the base of that chimney, over.
Venting fluid glimmers in Jake's light as it rises.
It looks pretty hot, though, Kevin.
It's like a burning tree stump. That is just incredible. Okay, it looks like most of the fluid is coming out here and here. Can we go in right there?
I will do the best I can, but I'm working really hard here.
We're in some kind of convective flow here.
The bot inches closer to the chimney with a tubular probe extended. The Jake cam shows fluid churning around the probe.
Well, you're in there now. You want it close. You're close.
Be careful.
Looks like he's in a blowtorch, doesn't it? I think he's getting hit. Mike, back up. You got the top of the bot is right in the vent fluid, over.
Can you see if I'm in the hot water?
Really want to know?
Kevin looks out a porthole.
Thanks, Mike. Just be the bot, Mike. Be the bot. Stay calm. You got it.
And I'm going to just do this as quick as I can.
Yeah.
Jake jams the probe into the chimney.
Oh, yeah.
I think we got it.
Jake backs up.
Hey, we gotta just go cap this sample. We just poked it right into the chimney.
Yeah, copy that. Congratulations. Go back and cap it.
Roger that.
Kevin and Mike watch a monitor.
Coming home.
On the ship, they examine Jake.
Yeah, look at Jake. Jake took some hits.
Well, other than the damage here and here, it looks in pretty good shape.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. Pretty intense.
Diving with Mike was great fun. He is a mastermind with the robot. I didn't realize how much went into making that bot work right.
Mike and an assistant work on Jake.
A little more deep.
The bot had to be small so that it could fit on the mirror. It had to have its own onboard power supply.
Okay, back to neutral and we're ready to go.
inside the sub. I have a laptop and a joystick, and that's all I have inside the sub.
In a mirror sub with Loretta, Mike moves the joystick, and Jake advances underwater.
The fiber is unique. It allows us to send a light pulse back and forth to the vehicle. That's how we talk to the vehicle.
9 North, East Pacific Rise, 3,150 meters.
And we can control the little camera as well.
Footage from the Jake cam shows a steep wall.
The bot creates a telepresence for us. It actually allows us to feel like we're outside of the submarine.
All right, I'm going to get a little bit closer.
Oh, he's beautiful.
I never saw anything like this. Look at him. Uh-oh, he sees us now. Hey, hey, hey.
He's going after you.
Look, he's grabbed the gripper. He's putting his tentacles on the gripper.
This is cool. Who's grabbing who?
That was incredible.
He deliberately reached right out and probed the gripper.
I've never had an encounter like that with the ROV, with an animal that came right up to us and touched the ROV like that.
It was an extraordinary encounter. It was as though I got to shake hands with an alien. As an underwater explorer, that was probably one of the highlights of my whole experience underwater.
It's not hard to imagine that someday it would be possible to explore oceans on another world. So, getting an idea of what it's like to explore these extreme environments on our own planet could very well pave the way to exploring Europa.
Computer animation shows a spacecraft drifting toward one of Jupiter's moons. Components puff exhaust as the craft hurtles toward Europa's marbled surface.
A mission to explore under the ice of Europa would be the ultimate robotic challenge.
With 4 disc-shaped landing pads, the craft spins in space. A thruster on the hull shoots flames, and the craft descends.
During the landing, the team in mission control would pretty much be along for the ride.
As the exploration craft nears Europa's surface, it jettisons the thruster. Jupiter looms in the background as the craft descends into an icy gorge.
Europa is so far away that even at the speed of light, it would take more than an hour for the command just to reach the vehicle. It's really on its own. It has to be smart enough to avoid terrain hazards and to find a good landing site on the ice.
The craft levels out as it drops toward a barren ice field. Hauling a crayon-shaped probe that runs the length of the hull, the craft touches down in a swirling cloud of steamy mist. The round end of the crayon-shaped probe rises, driving the pointy end toward the ice. The tip glows red.
Now we have to get through the ice. You need a melt probe. It's basically a nuclear heated torpedo.
As the red-hot tip bores into the ice, steam rises. The view sinks below the surface as the free-falling probe descends through crystal-clear ice.
The ice could be anywhere from 3 to 16 miles deep. Week after week, the melt probe will sink of its own weight through the ancient ice. Until finally,
the probe releases an anchor, then sinks deeper on a tether line. The red-hot tip breaks through the bottom layer of ice, and the probe drops into water. The tether grows taut, stopping the probe, which glows with a ring of lights.
Now, what are you going to do when you reach the surface of that ocean?
The tip of the probe drops away, and a robotic submersible emerges from the body of the probe.
You need an AUV, an autonomous underwater vehicle. It needs to be one smart puppy, able to navigate and make decisions on its own in an alien ocean.
A propeller spins, turning the capsule-shaped vehicle that shines bright lights on an underwater cavern. The vehicle cruises toward rock formations on the seafloor. Its headlights illuminate the blue water as it passes over a knobby spire next to a sheer wall. Black plumes of smoke rise from towering chimneys.
Europa has internal heat. It may well have hydrothermal venting. If it does, and if the chemistry is right...
The vehicle shines its lights on alien sea creatures. One resembles a transparent squid, with delicate tentacles that trail behind its body and wing-like fins on either side of its head. Another creature swims over with lacy veins on its fins and glowing antennae.
It will have an enormous impact on humanity if we find life in an ocean on another world.
On Earth, The team ship motors on a calm sea.
But in order to find it, we have to go there.
In a rover, Jim sits at the controls as the submersible descends.
And to go there, we have to continue the journey here.
Jake extends on its tether.
Exploration is like a muscle. You have to exercise it to make it stronger. And if water is the common ingredient for life, we need to take what we know about deep ocean exploration and apply it to space, giving scientists and explorers the experience they'll need to follow the water, wherever it might be.
On deck, Dejana watches the night sky.
Discovering life at the vents shows us that nature has more to teach us than we can possibly imagine. But I wonder, what would it be like if we were exploring the ocean on another world?
In a futuristic submersible, Dejana and Kevin explore underwater.
I'll stop.
Stopping.
Hold it steady here. It might completely change our definition of life.
Let's see what they do.
The scientists shine their sub's lights on alien sea creatures. One has a turtle-shaped body and big yellow eyes on a tall head that tapers into two antennae that curve back like antelope horns. In the bubble-shaped cockpit, Dejana presses her hand against the clear sphere, and the creature mirrors the gesture with a two-fingered tentacle. Dejana smiles.
Right on.
Houston Endurance, we have arrived on station of the coordinates, and we have some new friends.
A bioluminescent creature swims by, headed for a glowing city on the seafloor. On the futuristic submersible, a light illuminates the NASA logo beneath a whirling propeller. Gently moving sea creatures with rippling fins and bioluminescent spots swim around the majestic city. At the base of ornate towers, electric blue light emanates from rectangular windows.
Who knows what's out there? So we have to go.
Fade to black. Smoke swirls in darkness. Underwater chimneys spew thick black plumes. Teeming shrimp blanket a rock formation, spewing smoke. Swarming shrimp shroud a rock tower. Drifting upside down in the clear water, a shrimp kicks its skinny legs and flips right side up on its way to join the horde. In cobalt blue water, two rovers cruise above the seafloor. Gushing fluid rises from a vent and shimmers in the glaring light of a submersible. A rover sinks into the depths, its lights trained on a sheer wall. White and pale orange bacterial mats carpet the knobby ins and outs of a towering rock formation. Shrimp glint in the cool light as they flit through the blue water. Hot water ripples above the mushroom-shaped formation with a glassy underside that reflects a jagged surface. Elsewhere, tube worms clustered close together cover a craggy formation. Some have their red plumes extended and sway in the gentle current, while others with their plumes retracted look like white straws. On the seafloor, an octopus gently flaps its ear-like fins and kicks its legs as it cruises over the rocky bottom. Fade to black. This film has been described by Deluxe, with funding by Walt Disney Studios, voiced by Jedediah Barton.